I was actually asked to speak on a specific topic, which, by the way, I don't know how immediately relevant it is to most of you. It'd be especially relevant to people who are raising children. I guess more and more grandparents are raising children now, too. But I've been asked to speak about the subject of protecting our children. And, you know, in my parents' generation, parents wanted to protect their children, too. But protecting your children means teach them to look both ways before they cross the street. Don't get into cars with strangers. Don't play on the railroad tracks. You know, it was that kind of stuff. Maybe protecting them from physical harm. Because society in those days was not as dangerous for children as now. And I have to admit, when I was young and went to school, even in grammar school, they were teaching evolution and things like that. But they weren't teaching specifically against Christianity and Christian values. They didn't ridicule Christian truth. They were essentially, even though those my teachers in school were, I'm sure, not Christians, they felt obliged, if not so personally inclined, to affirm most Christian values and to respect the faith, even of children. When I was in second grade, I had a bit of a confrontation. I confronted my second grade teacher about something in the curriculum where they were talking about the origins of the world, and I told her that's not really what the Bible says. And instead of ridiculing me in front of the whole class, as probably would happen in most classes today, she said, "Oh, I guess they forgot that," or something. She deflected. I don't know if she was a Christian or not. I didn't go to Christian school, but she at least had to show some respect to my views. Because that's how culture was. Culture showed respect to Christianity because they recognized the value that Christianity was to the society and the debt that was owed to society by Christianity and of course the fact that the values of the Bible were something that were good for societies, even if people weren't totally surrendered to God as they should be, they were nonetheless of a consensus for the most part that biblical truth was in fact truth. Maybe they were beginning to have their doubts about things like Genesis chapter 1 and probably some other things, and a lot of people rejected Christian morality for their own personal lives, but they didn't reject it officially. And they didn't come out as an attack against Christian truth, but that's not true now. It's not true now in our world in general. It's not true even in among those institutions that are affecting our children. So my parents never had to worry that the public school I went to was intending to corrupt my morals. And, you know, they didn't have to protect me from that. I went to church, I was taught my parents' views as a child. I held them all through my schooling, and to this day, if I've changed anything, it's to be more biblical, not to be less so. But I appreciate my parents, and they should appreciate the society they were raising Christian children in. My siblings and I all have been Christian since our youth and still serve the Lord. So my parents are among the most fortunate and enviable people in that respect. So what do we need to protect our children from? Well, first of all, Christians have always had to protect their children from the main enemies of humanity, which are enemies of our children as well, like the flesh and the world, which is the dominant culture, and, of course, the devil. These are the three things that the Bible identifies as our opponents in our spiritual warfare in our lives. What life is a struggle against a dominant culture, which, as I say, in former times, the dominant culture had a lot more in common with Christianity. But nonetheless, the world in general, especially that which has not been affected by Christianity, is very much against the truth of God. But so is our flesh, our natural bent. We all have fleshly desires that make their demands upon us, and we are in a warfare against that. Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 2, my brother and I exhort you that you will abstain from fleshly lusts that war against your soul. So your fleshly desires war against your soul. Now, children, we sometimes mistakenly think, because I think the culture is trying to make us think this, that children are just small versions of adults. They're really pretty much like us. They're just smaller. They'll get big, but they're already like adults, sort of. And of course, this has been sort of a message in our culture from the time of, even shortly after my childhood, when families were depicted on TV as, small societies of people where the children were smarter than the parents. Usually the father was the most unintelligent person in the family, and he'd get the family into trouble, and the kids, through their brilliance, would save the parents out of problems. Not every show had that theme, certainly not the Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best era, but later, that's pretty much what it was. Parents are pretty stupid, kids are pretty mature and smart, and even Disney was making movies a few decades ago about spy kids who are saving their parents from stupid things their parents do, and that's kind of the message, that kids are really quite competent. Kids are really quite rational. They're really quite capable. All you have to do is kind of educate them about, certain things, but they can pick up on things and process them and rationally assess them pretty much by themselves. Now, the Bible doesn't agree with that. In Proverbs, it says foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. And the rod, which stands for discipline and training, will drive it from them. The natural bent of a child is not toward godliness. I believe that children often are born with a sensitivity to God, but they don't have the wisdom of God. They need to be trained in godly wisdom. And they need to be trained, for example, to discipline their flesh, which is an enemy of their soul. And this is something that in our society, Christians have neglected to a great extent. We see this especially in the rise of childhood obesity. Recent studies have indicated that as many as 1 in 5 children under 17 are obese. Now, why would any child be obese? Well, because they're they're sedentary. They don't go out and run and play and do as much outside. Instead, they sit at computer screens and iPads and watch Netflix and things like that. And when you're just sitting and watching things, and then you're eating a lot of, junk food, typically there's nowhere to go except toward obesity. And unfortunately, children have not been raised enough. Some have, apparently, because it's only 1 in 5, but that's a huge number. Children need to be taught not to eat wrong and to not sit around and do nothing. This is not a Christian value per se, but it is certainly a stewardship value, and Christianity is concerned about stewardship. Whatever God has given us, we are stewards and responsible to manage. And how we manage our bodies, how we manage our time, these are all issues that are not of no concern to God. And if we don't teach our children to manage their appetites and to say no to their flesh and to make wise choices in which desires of their bodies to curtail, well, then when they get to, in their teenagers or whatever, they're going to have other desires of their bodies, but they have no mentality for curtailing. And so sex and alcohol and other things that they're going to crave, if they've not been taught from youth to say no to everything that their body is inclined toward, which is harmful or immoral, you're going to have problems with it. And I have to say many Christian parents whose desire is to protect their children overlook this particular thing. I'm amazed how many kids are simply allowed to eat junk all the time, to do nothing that resembles exercise, and to just waste away watching a screen, which is the thing that kids do. I see toddlers, playing with their parents' iPhones and things like that. And they're probably more adept at it than the parents are, because kids are born knowing technology now, I think. I still can't learn it because I came around too early, but it's amazing to me how little kids can do all kinds of things on their phones and iPads that I don't know how to do. But that's because the iPhone or the iPad has become a babysitter for children from an early age. Parents used to have to find ways to engage their children in normal life and train them and pay attention to them. But parents are kind of overworked now in many cases too. Now it's moms and dads are both out at work instead of one of them at home giving all their time to the home and to the children. And for that reason, it's easier just to turn the child over to an electronic babysitter. And that being so, you know, it's very hard for real life to compete with the drama and the fantasy and so forth that kids can find on a screen. And so we actually need to teach them that their bodies are to be used for the glory of God, that they are to offer themselves as a living sacrifice and to yield their members as instruments of God to righteousness. Now, you don't want to make your kids hyper-religious. I don't think being religious is particularly virtuous. And you're not going to want to deprive your kids of all fun, but there's a rational measuring out of, you know, activities that children do in leisure. And parents can't do that if they're not involved, if they're not really paying attention, if they're using these items, you know, never saying no to their child when they want some kind of junk food or something, because they don't want to really, they don't want any conflict with the child. They don't want to have to face that. You know, if you don't say yes to your kid and they haven't been well trained, well then they're going to put up a fuss and they're going to be more trouble than if you just yield to them. And so the lazy parent will simply yield to what the child wants, give them the junk they want, let them watch the things they want, let them play with what they want, and they will not learn to curtail any of the desires of their flesh. Parents often will let the kids go to bed when they want to at night, not instead of when they should, and you know, just the body has its own set of rhythms and desires that it wants, which have to be interfered with by some form of discipline. And I don't believe in harsh discipline necessarily, unless it's absolutely necessary, but I do believe that discipline has got to be imposed on a child from a very early age. You know, many times parents, when they have a baby, if the baby starts fussing, they'll just give the baby something to distract it, because it's easier instead of, you know, frankly, it's, you know, teaching the baby that they've got to go to sleep when it's the parent's decision that they do so. And the child doesn't get to throw a fit at the high chair and throw things on the floor. I mean, children have to be taught who's in charge very early. And that once they learn that early, it's not so hard for them to discipline their flesh. They're still going to have problems with flesh because they're human. Humans all do have a problem with flesh. But the fewer problems you give your children, the better. You got to protect them from the dangers of just an unbridled sense of entitlement to have whatever their flesh wants. You got to build into the children a mentality that their desires do not have, they're not self-validating. The fact that I desire something doesn't mean it's a valid thing that I deserve or that I'm entitled to. Sense of entitlement is also a serious problem among young people because parents have not really had the courage to say no to their children. And sometimes once they realize their children are really a monster, the child's old enough that it's really hard to impose that on them. You've got to be pretty much a hands-on parent from early on. Now, I'm not wanting anyone to feel guilty because I know there's a lot of people who are single moms. You know, they feel like they have to work. They have to leave their children with caregivers and things like that. And I think alternatives to those necessities should be sought, and I think the church should be looking for ways to help mothers in that respect. But it takes intensity. It takes giving it priority. The raising of a child is the priority of a parent when the child is young. It won't be forever. You know, the child will be an adult in a few years. You're there, you're just borrowing them from God. God has actually lent them to you to train and to launch into the world. But hopefully you're supposed to launch them as straight arrows. It says in Psalm 127 that children are like arrows in the hands of a mighty man. You're launching them into the world, hopefully as agents of change, as weapons against the powers of darkness. But they're not these straight arrows if you let them shape themselves according to their lusts. The Bible warns against, you know, conforming yourself to the lusts that you had in the days of your ignorance, as you did before. As a believer, we know that our bodies are to be yielded to God, our members of our bodies, instruments of righteousness. And little children can be, I mean, I don't expect children to understand these concepts deeply. They don't have to understand when they're little. The purpose of raising children is to teach them and mold them in good behavior. They can still choose bad things when they're older, but the less you mold them, the more guaranteed they are to make bad decisions later on. And if children, you know, you tell your child to do something and they say, why? Obviously, you know, the old answer, because I said so, is still the right answer. When children need to be taught that somebody has the right to say so to them, that there's authority, that God's ordained authority in their life. To many of today's young people don't seem to have any concept of authority. I mean, they don't have any respect for the police. And I have to say that sometimes the police are bad and do wrong things, but I mean, still, the police are needed, and to be up in the face of a policeman, as you sometimes, during the Black Lives Matter riots a couple of years ago, you'd see on TV, these, you know, creepy, you know, young men, or women even, with their faces up to the police, shouting and cursing the police and so forth. These are children who were never taught anything about authority. And the first authority that child experiences is the parent. And for the parent to say, it's because I said so, and you are obligated to do it. Eventually, you can tell them because God said you have to do it, you know, which is true. And it says in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 through 3, Paul says, he says, fathers, don't provoke your children. No, before that, it says, children, obey your parents, for this is right in the Lord. He says, honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with a promise that it may be well with you, and you might live long in the land that the Lord your God has given you. You see, what the promise is that it'll go well with you if you respect your parents. You know, children say, why should I have to obey you? Because God wants things to go well for you. And if you respect me, God indicates it'll go well with you. And if you don't respect my authority, it will not go well for you. I'm not in this for me. I'm in this for you. You know, I'm correcting you. I'm depriving you of some things that you would maybe prefer, because that's what parents do who care about their children. Children, people who don't care about their children, they let their children run wild. That's why the Bible says he that spares the rod hates his son. If you don't discipline, you don't shape their life, you hate them. Now you might think, no, it's because I'm so sympathetic. I'm on their side. I love them. I don't want to displease them. I can't stand to see them unhappy. Yeah, that's you you're looking out for. You don't like to see them unhappy. Their being unhappy is actually a good thing at times. Because if you only allow things that make them happy, they'll be sinning. When you will not prevent your children from doing things that make, you know, and you make them unhappy by preventing that, you're protecting yourself from the discomfort of a conflict that you don't want. But you're in authority. And they need to be taught to respect that from early on. Now, once they get to like, whatever, 12, 13, some age, of course kids are more precocious nowadays, it might even be 10, but when the children begin to think more rationally and make more rational arguments, then if they say, why do we have to do this? That's the time you need to show them there are good reasons for it. Before that, they don't need to be reasoned with. When they say, why do I have to obey you? What you're doing is, if you argue with them or if you explain to them, you're giving them the impression that they have a right to disobey if you can't give a good answer. They don't. If you can't give a good answer, that doesn't make a difference. They still have to obey. Don't give them the impression that they have a right to demand from you an explanation for your choices. You are in authority, and that's what they need to be taught first. When they're very young, they need to be taught, mom and dad, you don't even have to say mom and dad know best. Whether that's true or not, mom and dad are in authority, and my role as a child is to obey. And that's why when the child says, why do I do this? You say, because I said so, and I'm the one making the decisions here, and you're the one who's obeying. That's how it works in this family. That's how it works in the world. And then when they're older, they don't, you know, that becomes a rather contemptuous kind of answer. When they're old enough to be reasoning things out and wondering, you know, is this really making sense? Well, that's when you begin to phase in your explanations. You need to show them that you're not just an authoritarian, but you have their interests at heart and you have rational reasons for your values. And so that's when you begin to inter-rational explanations for things to the children. But they need to be conformed to godly standards, which require, of course, the curtailing of many of their fleshly appetites. And that, again, is one of those things that we see a generation of young people, and people who wouldn't, 50 years ago, these people at their age would not be considered young people. We're talking about people in their mid-30s. They're still juvenile. They're untrained. They're like babies. They're snowflakes. They can't stand to have someone say no or even to disagree. These are somehow people who were supposed to be adults long ago, but their parents failed them. Now you might say, well, I was a good parent, but my kids turned out this way. It was society that corrupted them. Well, who was supposed to protect them from that? And that's what we're trying to argue. How do we protect our children from that? Because you might do nothing wrong in the home, honestly, literally. You might be a very good Christian, a very good example. You might teach what you should teach. But when your kids go off to school, or when they go off into unsupervised play with neighbor kids, or when they are let loose on a screen of some kind, an iPad, a phone, or television, if you're not making sure that your values are reinforced in all of those circumstances, you're negligent. It's a very high labor-intensive thing to raise children. That's why God usually assigns that to younger adults. When grandparents have to raise their grandchildren, it's much harder. Although the grandparents have more wisdom, they also have much less energy. And I was talking to a friend yesterday who has children in their 30s who are having given him grandchildren, young grandchildren now. And I was saying, when I was young, I wanted to have 12 children. I wish I had 12 children. God didn't give us that many, so I got what we got. But I just loved raising children. And I loved the idea that I'm raising another generation for God. I'm going to be gone someday. And these are like arrows being launched into the future to make an impact for God. That I always had that vision for my children and loved it. But I told him, at this point, the idea of becoming a parent, of course, you don't become a parent when you're 70 unless you have a very, very young wife. But like Abraham, who had a wife 10 years younger than him, still she's 90. But the idea of taking on the task of raising small children, I don't envy young parents now. First of all, because there is so much more working against them. You can defeat it, but you've got to be so much, it's so labor intensive now to fight the whole world on behalf of your children. You got to do it. But I think if I was 30 and thinking about that, I'd say, bring it on, let's fight this battle. I've always seen the world as a battleground between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Satan. And bring them on. We've got resources. We've got weapons of our warfare that are mighty through God that can bring every thought in captivity to the obedience of Christ. We've got all it takes. And I still believe that. The only thing is I don't have the energy I used to have. As a person almost 70 years old, the thought of starting over and fighting off the whole world against my children, it makes me weary to think about it. Because I just don't have that energy anymore. But that's why God usually gives the raising of children to young people, young parents. Because they have the energy and they need it. Because it's a labor-intensive thing. And it's worth it. I mean, when you think about it, if you say, well, but if I were to stay home with my kids, or if I was put in the energy of watching everything my kids did, or at least having some control when they're young over everything they are exposed to, I wouldn't be able to do anything. Well, is there something more important that you know of? Is there something more important to you than raising kids who aren't going to give you heartbreak when you're older and make the world a worse place and go to hell when they're done? I mean, is there something you've got on your schedule, on your calendar, more important than that? I can't imagine what it would be. Yeah, life is work. And for young parents, that work involves protecting their children. And that includes, from early age, molding them with reference to their attitudes toward their fleshly desires and their appetites, what they eat, when they sleep, things like that. That's all fleshly stuff. But we have another enemy besides the flesh that they have to be warned against, and that is, of course, the world. And by the world, I mean the dominant culture. The dominant culture now, unlike when I was a child, is specifically targeting Christians, children, for destruction. It's specifically desiring to destroy the innocence of children. See, I'll tell you this. Even though I went to a public school, there weren't many Christian teachers there as far as I know. It was a secular culture that I was raised in. There was nobody in the educational establishment that I've ever become aware of back then that wanted to destroy the innocence of children. I think everyone agreed pornography should not be anywhere near children. And, you know, and they shouldn't be allowed to use foul language around them because children are supposed to be innocent. But as I was saying, people now look at children as small adults. And that's why they have child drag shows. I assume that you're aware of that. One of the upcoming things is children in drag. That is, boys dressed like girls and walking a runway for a bunch of perverted audience, usually, you know, gay men, who want to lust after them. And, you know, this, anyone who did this would have been put in jail 50 years ago. Now, it's celebrated. This, you know, the more you can take away the innocence of a child and make them sexually sophisticated or corrupted or perverted, well, you know, the more congratulations you get from the dominant culture. I mean, it's the public schools, the public libraries, certainly Disney Channel. Everything is now, I've never watched the British show for kids. It's cartoon Peppa Pig. They just introduced the gay characters because 22,000 people signed a petition saying the show needed to introduce more diversity. And so little kids are being taught that, you know, gay couples as parents is a norm that should be embraced. They're not being told it. It's just being assumed in their culture, in their cartoons, in the stories that they read, in the way that they are encouraged to learn their friends' pronouns, you know, and things like that. So it's not like somebody who's just coming up to a child and says, you need to become corrupt. You need to become perverted. It's that that's all just kind of filtering in. Those are things that are part of the culture now, which I think most Christians are aware of, which I doubt if any of us when we were growing up, our parents had to contend with that. So how do parents contend with that? It's us against the world for our children. Now, some people say that just sounds paranoid. You know, the world, the whole world's not against you. Hey, wake up. The world has always been against the kingdom of God, but in much more subtle ways 50 years ago than now. Now there's no subtlety. They'll come right out and say that if you teach Christian values, if you believe in traditional marriage, if you believe in, you know, biological definitions of sex and gender, that you're not only backward, you're not only a dinosaur, you're kind of dangerous. You're thwarting the progress of our society. You're bringing hate into the world, you know? I mean, this is literally what they think. This is not just their jargon. This is what they really believe. This is how messed up they are. And this is the world your children, or in most of your cases, your grandchildren probably, are being raised in and need to be protected from. That's the world. You need to teach children to not be conformed to this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of their mind. As Paul said in Romans 12, 2. The world is not the standard for us. It never has been for Christians. It is for people who aren't Christians because they don't know anything else than the world. They are the world. That's what they are. That's their culture. That's their reality. For Christians, we know a different reality. We know there's another king. We know that there's a God. We know that there's a judgment. We know that there's every thought and act is going to be judged and rewarded or you know, punished as necessary at some point. We have information that the world doesn't hold to. And that information gives us a worldview that tells us almost everything that children are being taught formally is wrong. And it's not just wrong like somebody's making a mistake. It's wrong in that it's malicious against childhood. It's malicious against innocence. it's malicious against everything Christian or biblical. This is simply the world we live in. If I had said that 30 years ago, and I did, I think many Christians say, oh, come on, you're kind of overdoing this a little bit. Really? You know, like the whole world's against us? Give it a break. Are you paranoid or what? I have a feeling that not one person here who's awake and knows what's going on in the world thinks I'm being extreme here. This is what we all know. This is what the world is no longer trying to conceal. They're trying to say, you Christians are not welcome here. Your views are not welcome here. And yet, our children, our grandchildren are being raised to live in this world. And we've got to equip them and protect them against those mindsets. And we've got to make sure they have a biblical worldview, which isn't the easiest thing in the world when the other worldview is forced upon them from all kinds of sources. I'm going to give some practical suggestions, but another enemy besides the flesh of the world obviously has always been the devil. And by the devil and demons, I would suggest that that can include everything we've talked about so far, because the devil is the deceiver. And all the deception that's in our culture is something that the devil is pleased to promote. But there's more than that, too. There's the very, very sinister aspects of the devil's kingdom. There's the demonic. There's the occult. And frankly, plenty of kids are being encouraged to be interested in that. They're attracted to magic. They're attracted to witchcraft. This is not new, by the way. I mean, in my generation, kids were too. In fact, it might have been more visible in my generation. I'm not sure, but because I don't see it as much, because I don't look at the YouTube channels. I don't follow the media that children are watching. But from what I understand, what I've studied from sociologists and so forth, is that the occult is extremely popular among the youth, and so children need to be taught. Now, see, the occult was not that well known among Christians when I was young. I remember that my parents were Christians and good Christians. And my sister, when she was maybe 13 years old, she and some of her friends who were not Christians, but she was, we were all kind of nominally Christian in those days, she and her friends started getting involved in the Ouija board. They didn't get involved with it for very long because it got kind of scary, and they just stopped doing it. But my parents didn't know what a Ouija board was. They didn't know to say anything about it. You know, we didn't know anything about the occult then. Now, by the time I was an adult, everybody, all Christians knew that Ouija boards were occult and that you shouldn't do them. But the occult, the fascination with the occult was emerging in the 60s and the 70s when I was growing up. And it's here now. It's here now, and it's a very virulent alternative to traditional spirituality that many people will consider. The interesting thing is that our world is very secular, very carnal, but there's still a spiritual hunger in humans by nature. They can suppress it. They can numb it. They can pretend it's not there. They can distract themselves from it with anything that's fleshly and carnal. But frankly, there's still something that's calling out for transcendence, for meaning. You know, just sex, drugs, and alcohol, those things, they don't give any meaning. But spirituality is something that's built into people. It's a very neglected side in certain generations, but there are many in every generation that are looking for something to quell their spiritual need. Now, what Satan has done very cleverly is that in the generation before mine, he promoted what we call naturalism, which is the belief that there's no supernatural. You know, the nature is all there is. Believing in the supernatural is kind of kooky, kind of superstitious. And the devil did that so that people would stop believing in miracles, stop believing the Bible, and things like that. But then in the 60s and the early 70s, once the devil had pretty much undermined belief in the Bible with many people, with a large portion of the population, he began to reintroduce spirituality because he knew that you can't suppress people's spiritual nature forever. It's going to cry out for something more than just physical, you know, pleasure. People need some sense of meaning and transcendence. But now that the devil had eliminated from the culture a firm belief in the Bible, not that there weren't people who believed the Bible, there's always been people who believe in the Bible, but in terms of it being understood by almost everybody as the Word of God and as something that should be, you know, honored and believed, that belief was undermined by naturalism, And then, of course, Satan reintroduced spiritual things to meet that spiritual hunger, but they were the occult. And now, I think with very many young people, when they get to the age where they realize they need something more spiritual in their life, they don't even think of Christianity as one of the options. Some do, but a lot of them, especially who are raised in religious homes, feel like, oh, I've been there, done that, you know. And I guess I did the Christian thing, and I don't know, that didn't do anything for me. So now I'm going to, as I feel a need for any spirituality at all, I'm going to look for it wherever something exciting is going on, something spooky, something, mysterious. And so the occult is very much an option in the minds of many young people who would not consider Christianity as an option. And they don't know why they wouldn't consider Christianity as an option. They just grew up in a culture that decided not to trust in Christianity anymore. They don't have good reasons. And every good Christian parent knows that the reasons for believing Christianity are very profound. It's the only religious worldview that has any evidence at all in its favor, and it has a great deal. The evidence for the resurrection of Christ is unimpeachable. No one could really argue effectively against the actual historical evidence for the resurrection of Christ. The only argument that can be made is that kind of thing just doesn't happen. Which means instead of making an argument, they're being prejudiced. They're just saying we don't believe anything supernatural can happen. Yeah, but they'll believe in the occult, but they won't believe in biblical miracles. They don't realize they're inconsistent, but the arguments for Christianity, for the Bible being true, the archaeological evidences and all the historical evidences, which those of us from another generation who did our research on this know, there's the evidence is entirely for the Bible. Not one piece of evidence has ever been discovered that undermines the Bible. People say, well, what about evolution? Well, first of all, evolution is still a theory, but even if it were true, it doesn't necessarily undermine the Bible completely. I don't believe in evolution, but there are Christians who do. There are people who believe that you can interpret Genesis in a way that God used evolution. That's, to my mind, a mistake. But it doesn't prevent someone from believing the Bible's true. They just believe that Genesis 1 is symbolic or something like that, but they still accept the Bible as true, and it can accommodate, in their minds, evolution. And that's probably the main thing that comes to people's minds when they say, well, the Bible has been proven not true because evolution has been proven true. Well, evolution has not been proven true. But even if it were, that would simply have to let us say, okay, well, if evolution really did happen, then that's how God did it. It doesn't disprove anything about the story of Adam and Eve, of the fall, of Noah's flood. Certainly no evidence has come up against those. Those things just seem too spectacular to be believed by the modern skeptic. But there's never been any evidence against them produced. There's no proof that there is no God. There's no proof of anything that Hinduism, Buddhism, or Islam claims to be true. And there's no religion, there's no worldview that has any evidence in its favor except Christianity. Now, if someone says, wait a minute, I think I know some evidence for another view, I'd be glad to hear it. I've been checking it out for about 50 years, and I believe I'm speaking knowledgeably about this. When people think they have evidence for something else, it's often an argument based on their philosophical presuppositions about it. It's not hard evidence. There is hard evidence for the scriptures being true. There's certainly hard evidence historically for Jesus being risen from the dead. But people aren't taught to think rationally about evidence anymore. Children in school are taught to affirm their feelings. They don't follow the science. And this is how the devil always works. He always has slogans that he says we should be following, but his own camp does not follow. Whether it's about COVID, whether it's about gender, whether it's about origins of species, they say follow the science. And yet, when you do look at the science, it's against what they're saying. And if you point that out, then you're a hater. You're not being reasonable. Because reasonableness has always led to belief in what the Bible says. Because that's how it is. Truth always has the best arguments. If the Bible is not true, then of course you'd have to come up with some fancy arguments that make it sound true if you want to believe it. But what you have to do now is ignore all evidence if you want to say it's not true. Because all the evidence favors it. And I know that sounds sweeping, that sounds might even sound irresponsible, but that's actually a subject I've looked into for half a century and debated atheists and debated evolution, debated people about. I happen to have some information about that, and I'm not the least bit afraid to say to any crowd, it doesn't have to be a Christian crowd, maybe it seems like I'm preaching to the choir here, but If this is a crowd of atheists, I'd say the same things. The only worldview that has evidence in its favor is the biblical worldview. You can't prove atheism. You can just deny there's a God because you don't want to believe in a God. There's no evidence that there's no God. Everything they bring up that is an objection to God is usually an emotional thing. I don't like, you know, there's evil in the world. How could there be a God who allows evil? Well, that's a good question. We should work on that. But it doesn't prove there isn't a God just because there's evil. You know, maybe there's, there could be a God and evil. And there is. And why there is, we could discuss that. But don't just assume that because there's evil and you emotionally object to it, that now there must not be a God because you emotionally object to the idea. And this is, of course, what most atheists do. They're acting not rationally, but emotionally. It's funny because they'll accuse us, believers, of being the ones who are acting on emotion and irrationality. But the truth is, I've never heard an atheist, and I've read all their books, right? Not all their books, but all the main ones, like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and the main atheist authors. And I've listened to them do it, and I've debated some. I've never heard a single argument for atheism that wasn't simply an emotional argument. I don't like this God of the Bible. This God of the Bible is a monster. Well, that's your impression. I actually have studied the Bible, probably a little more than you have, and I don't see any evidence in there that God is a monster. But if that's what you think, you're still saying there's a God who's a monster. You're saying there's a God that you don't like. That's not the same thing as proving there's no God. And if there's a God that you don't like, you may still have the same problem on the judgment day as if there was a God that you did like. In fact, I have a feeling you'd have a bigger problem if you live your life not liking the God that is than if you conform yourself to him happily. Yeah, there's still a reality that's going to catch up to you like a freight train, you know, and you're on the tracks. You may say, I don't like that train. I don't like it coming after me. I don't like the fact that it's going to crush me. Well, you can get off the tracks. You can change your relationship with that reality. But to say you don't like it doesn't prove it's not reality. So the worldview that kids are being taught is simply irrationality. Frankly, the schools have ceased to teach children how to think critically and more to affirm their feelings. If you feel it, no one has the right to say you're wrong. It's your truth. You're living your truth. It's your lived truth. And nobody has any right to say you're wrong. You were born a boy, but you feel like you're a girl. No one has any right to say you're not a girl. If they say you're not, they're a hater. Well, not really. I think that those of us who are being asked to call you a girl might reasonably expect to be told why we should believe that you're a girl. Because if you were in the very same position 50 years ago, you would go to a psychiatrist and you'd be considered to be mentally ill. Now, what was always considered to be a mentally ill condition previously doesn't stop being a mentally ill condition just by culture saying, we're not going to call it that anymore. We're just going to call it true. And we're just saying it's true. You're right, of course. Nobody knows what gender you are, but you do. Even the parents don't know. Even the doctor doesn't know when you're born what gender you're going to be. They just have to guess. They assign you a gender. This is the rap they give now. But there's no reason to believe any of it. They're not following science. They don't have critically analyzed arguments. They just say, go with your feelings. You feel that way, who can say you're wrong? And therefore, we need to protect our children by making them think rationally. Even God said, come, let us reason together. Reasoning is a capacity that God gave humans and not animals. We have a stewardship of it. We have a responsibility. We need to learn to reason. We need to let reason, you know, it's not carnal to follow reasoning. God created reasoning and truth. Reasoning brings us, when it's done properly, to the truth. And God wants us to reach the truth. And he wants our children to be able to be protected from what is not true. Because what is not true always lacks in rational arguments. What is not true wins the day by bullying, by calling people who don't agree haters. It's by name calling. It's not by argument. Has there been any woke position that has, you know, earned its place in the academy or in culture by its rational arguments? Not one. Not one. It doesn't matter whether it's radical gender ideology, whether it's radical race theory, whether it's, homosexual marriage is normal, the LGBT whole thing, all that. They have gained acceptance in the culture as being, acceptable, but never has it been done by rational argument. It's always done by emotional. And when the Christian says, wait a minute, I don't see any reason to believe that. First of all, no one believed it before, day before yesterday, and now we're all supposed to be believing it. Why did we change our minds? We need to tell our kids that they don't have to fit in on this. And it's gonna cost them something. That's why we need to, of course, teach our children to love God and be faithful even unto death. Like Daniel. Daniel was not a little child, but he was probably a teenager when he was taken away into Babylon. He knew the God of Israel because he was from Israel. He was from Jerusalem. He was taken captive in war. As a teenager, he was taken into Babylon, a place where paganism was as bad as it is here. I once would have had to say, well, we're almost as bad as they were. But I think they are now. We could say they at Babylon and paganism was as bad as we are now, The one thing worse than here was that they didn't have people who knew God, except for the Jewish people who'd been taken captive there. Daniel didn't know a lot of Jewish friends. He had Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but there's evidence that they got stationed in the government somewhere different from where he was. He had a government position. But the Bible makes it very clear that Daniel knew he had to stand for God against the entire culture. He had to take a stand. It got him thrown into a lion's den. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did the same thing, just the three of them against the world. And they were thrown in a fiery furnace. Now, they were delivered, but not all Christians who've done the same thing have been delivered. There's been Christians who were fed to the lions and got eaten by lions. There's been Christians who've been burned up at the stake, and they burned up. Martyrdom is not unknown for godly people. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were also youths, and Daniel. Daniel was not a youth when he was thrown in the lion's den, but he was a youth when he was standing up against the pagan diet, when he said, I'm not going to eat the king's foods because that's against my Jewish convictions. He had to stand up against the culture, and he didn't know what the consequences would be. He didn't know if he's going to be spared from the judgment. That was apparently not a consideration. It wasn't for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when Nebuchadnezzar said, if you don't bow down to this idol, I'm going to throw in the fire furnace. And they said, well, we don't really have to answer you about this, king, because we're not going to change. If you're going to throw us into the fiery furnace, our God is able to deliver us from it. But if he doesn't, that's okay. We're still not going to change. They didn't know how it was going to turn out. They knew what they were going to do, and they're going to leave the outcome to God. Maybe we'll burn up. Maybe we won't. That's the heroism we have to build into our children. Of course, we're not going to build into them if we don't have it. This is what frustrates me sometimes talking to modern Christian adults, is I'm telling them how strong their Christian children have to be and the attitudes they have to have and the boldness they have to have and so forth. And many times the generations that's raising these kids doesn't have those qualities. Some do, but many don't. But we have to make sure that we have the very thing we're trying to inculcate, and we have to realize that the laziness with which many of us were raised in our Christian life, comfortably going to church, hanging out with Christians, putting a Jesus bumper sticker on our car. No one hated us. No one shot at us. No one threw us in fiery furnaces or in lion's dens. Those days are possibly, if not completely over, they're on their way out. The days are coming. And I don't say this as a prophet. I say this as someone who's just awake and looking at the world. The days are coming when our views are simply not going to be tolerated any more than Daniel's or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's were tolerated. And we have to be ready to say, hey, it's not for this life that I'm living necessarily. I'm living for God in this life. As long as I live, I'm here to live for God. But I don't expect to live forever here. And if the amount of time I do stay here ends up being shorter than I had planned, well, that's for God to decide, not for me. Mine is simply to be obedient and to be radically, committed to God and make sure that I see my children as one of the greatest stewardships God's given me to protect. Now, I want to say something about the education of children, because obviously a large portion of their childhood is spent in being educated. They have to learn how to read. They have to learn how to do math. They have to learn some technology nowadays. They should learn those things in school. They need to learn history, certainly. Boy, those who don't know history, you know the saying about that. Everyone quotes it. They're doomed to repeat it. Kids need to be taught history correctly. They need to learn math skills. They need to learn some technology. They need to learn language and communication arts. Of course, reading is very extremely important. Those things they need, but those are not necessarily the things that the schools are going to want to teach them. Some will. I mean, I live in California where things are really woke. You live in, perhaps you live in Missouri. Some of you are from out of state, but if you live in Missouri, that you've got a somewhat more conservative political environment. But still, the school systems in all the states are being infiltrated by the agendas of those who want to stamp out everything Christian. And I, when my kids were young, and that was very long ago, my oldest child is 49 years old. My youngest is, I think, 31 this year. So, you know, it was like a couple decades ago, or three decades ago, we were homeschooling our children. And I would have said everyone should homeschool their children. I personally think that is a great idea. I do believe young children at least should be homeschooled. When they become young adults, that's up to the parent to assess whether it's a good thing to expose them to, you know, more of the public schools while they're still at home. Parents have to make their own decisions about their own children because they know their children, and I don't know your children. But in general, my children seemed to be very strong Christians when they're in their early teens and throughout their childhood and in their early teens. And we homeschooled them all the way through. They never went to school, really. But I sometimes think, and some of my children felt this too, that if when they were strong Christians and high school age, if we put them in public high school, as I went through public high school, I was a strong Christian and I evangelized. I was a Christian influence there. But if we put them in public high school, which we really didn't want to do, and we didn't do, it would mean that they would still be in our home for like three or four more years under our oversight while they are being exposed to everything that they're going to be exposed to once they get out of our home. You know, it's kind of a hard thing to homeschool them all the way through high school, and they've not been exposed to most of the things that we protected them from, and then they get out, and they're not in your home anymore. Now they're exposed to them. It's kind of good to maybe ease them into what they're going to have to live with when they get out of your home, if possible, by letting them have exposure to it while you're still able to talk to them about it and correct things that are wrong. So I think I might have done things a little differently if I had to do over again, but I still think there's nothing wrong with homeschooling all the way through high school. But a lot of people feel they can't do it. But I think that homeschooling children, at least in the younger ages, is pretty necessary. A lot of people say, well, if Christians didn't put their kids in public school, who's going to evangelize that, you know, their peers? Well, usually if you put them in public school, they're not evangelizing their peers. They're probably not even allowed to. If they did, they'll probably go to the principal's office. Hey, you're not allowed to, you know, spread that hatred here, you know? And by the way, God, we have no example in the Bible of children being sent out as missionaries into the world. Children are not missionaries, generally speaking. I was a fairly strong Christian as a child, but I wish I'd been stronger. But the point is, you don't send children into Babylon unless they're as strong as Daniel. And Daniel is not a little child. Little children are in the forming stage. Their lives are being formed and need to be intensively formed by parental oversight. When they are in their, like to a Jew, typically age 13, you know, would be bar mitzvah age. That's when they're considered to be an adult, and that's when they begin to take on some adult responsibilities. That's when you can maybe expect them to reach out to their peers effectively. But most people are not going to be converted by a little kid. But if you do have a little kid who's capable of converting his friends, let him convert them somewhere else than at a public school. Because again, they won't be allowed to get very far doing that in public school. And public school is not a place where kids are focused on those kinds of things. They're supposed to be learning other things. And, you know, your kids can meet other kids in the neighborhood or in the park or somewhere under your supervision. But in public school, they're not under your supervision. I believe children need to be more now than ever under their parents' supervision. There have been times, even when my kids were young, we didn't send them to school, but we knew people who did put their kids in public school, and they had Christian school teachers. And they had good school teachers. And they didn't get corrupted. The teachers were not trying to make woke ideologues out of them. But that's probably going to be hard to find anymore. So homeschooling is very important. Now, I realize how frustrating it must be to anyone who's a single mom, especially, to be told you should homeschool. And I realize a single mom simply cannot do it sometimes. They have to work. But this is where I think the body of Christ needs to step up to protect our children. We need to identify who the single moms are who have school-aged children and either have the church support them like they would support the widows in biblical times so they can stay home and teach their children. Not stay home and just watch TV, but a mother who really wants to be committed to schooling her children, I think the church should step up and cover her rent, cover her, you know, basic expenses so that she can live maybe modestly. I always lived modestly. We always lived on one income, and it was not a very big one, but it was important to us. Homeschooling our kids was a value that we would not compromise. But if a woman wants to homeschool her kids, or a single man, and the church is willing to, you know, help support, underwrite their life, that's an investment the church is making in the kingdom of God, in the next generation. And the church should have a very much vested interest in their children being trained, if possible, at home. Now, if a Christian mother actually makes pretty good money outside the home, but isn't really very competent to school her children for some reason, then I think the church should also find its members who are competent to school them and provide for free, because I believe ministry should be voluntary. All my ministry I do is free. I've never charged for anything. And if I was doing other ministry, it'd be the same thing. What you do for God, you do for free, in my opinion. And if I were, let's say, not in this ministry, and I knew a family that, you know, the woman had to work, and she had kids at home, she wanted to homeschool them, and she wanted me to school them, if I did that, if I was an educator and could do that, I would do it for free. There was a church I was going to in Oregon for a while, and they had a lot of school teachers in the church. And they said, why don't we just start a Christian school here in the church? And, you know, our kids can be schooled here under our own teachers and protect them from public school. That was not a bad idea. I think it was a pretty good idea, actually. But they met several times to see how the logistics would work out, and they gave up the plan because they found out that the teachers, if they were employed by the church school, would not make as much as they made teaching the public school. And so since the church couldn't pay as much, they gave up the plan because the teachers wouldn't do it, you know, for a lower pay. Here, I was running a Bible school a block away from the church, and I wasn't being paid anything. I thought, you know, why would not these teachers see it as a ministry to step up and take less money? Well, we can't pay our bills or maintain our present standard of living. Well, is that important? Why can't you reduce your standard of living? Can't you somewhat live by faith? If you believe that you're serving God, can't you believe God's going to step up and he knows your needs? Don't you think God will make a way if you do the right thing? What's more important, that you make a bigger salary and have the benefits of being a public school teacher, or that you are serving the kingdom of God by raising children who don't have any other way of being raised and educated by Christians? I believe the church has got to take a strong position against farming out our children to the pagan schools, the government schools. We're going to turn them against us. And the church needs to say, one way or another, we need to make sure that all of our parents who have school-age kids and who want to can get them educated either by their mother at home, if we have to underwrite her lifestyle to do it, or by members of the church who love God and who will volunteer to, she can go to work if she needs to, and they can do what has to be done to help her raise her kids. These are things that churches, I don't know what churches do with their money. Oh, I know, they pay salaries a lot of times, which is probably one of the biggest expenses. Sometimes they pay big building costs, and, you know, I don't know what else they spend their money on, but to me, because I've never run a church, but it seems to me like a lot of money comes into churches, and it seems like it could be used for the kingdom of God, in many cases, considerably more wisely. And seeing children educated in a Christian environment or in their home environment, either one, is certainly something the church should be committed to making happen. A mother and a father needs to make sure they know what the curriculum is of their child. If, in fact, they have their children in public school because they have no other choice, I think they should drop in periodically unannounced. Just step up and stand in the back and hear what the teacher's saying. Now, I don't know, eventually the teacher probably said, you can't be here. I don't know why they'd be able to say that, but I think they probably would. But if the teacher thought the parent might just show up anytime, even for 5 minutes, and listen in, they might be thinking all the time, I don't know if the parent's going to show up. I better make sure I'm teaching something that's not going to be embarrassing for them to hear. We need to keep people accountable who are influence our children. And besides education, of course, there's the other issues, the media. Now, I have some information here which you might have heard. There are certain tech leaders that won't let their kids use tech. You probably have heard this. Steve Jobs, for example, founder of Apple Computers. When the iPad came out, he was asked by a journalist, you know, I'll bet your kids love the iPad. He said, they haven't used it. We limit how much technology our kids can use at home. He had 10-year-old twin boys, and he wouldn't let them use an iPad. His partner, Jonathan Ive, who also designed the iPad, he said that he strictly limits his 10-year-old kids' use of technology. Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft, didn't allow his kids to have cell phones until they were 14. And then he set time limits on their screens and banned phones at the dinner table. In the Silicon Valley in California, where there's a high concentration of tech companies, a huge number of workers in the tech companies send their kids to the, the Steiner-Waldorf schools. And they do so because those schools deprive the students of all technology and screens till they're 12, at least. Now, of course, I think 12 might be a little young, but these are people who don't have Christian values. They want to protect their kids from their own products. And they don't even care as much as we do about what their kids are learning. They just know they're dangerous. You know, there was a leak from an internal memo at Facebook. They did some internal research, and they admitted that Facebook is harmful to youth, especially young girls. Now, they didn't let it out. A leaker let it out, but they knew that. Now, these people, they know they're putting out products that are bad for kids, and in many cases, they protect their own kids from it. And when you think about it, they know more about their products than we do. I mean, they spend their life designing them. I'm sure they do all kinds of impact studies and so forth on their products. Everyone who develops something has to do that. They know the results that their products are getting, and they're saying, not my kids. My kids are not going to have that, you know? And they are motivated to promote their products and to put the happy face on their products more than anything. And yet they're saying, not my kids. I'm not going to let them touch that stuff. It's poison, you know? And they don't even have Christian values. I mean, they probably have really low moral values compared to what you want for your children. And yet they still are protected. So, I mean, I believe the kids should not have their own smartphones. Now, if I were raising kids today, even the younger ones, I would give them, you know, some kind of a track phone or a flip phone or something so I could call them. They could call me in emergency or whatever. Might as well. My kids were raised without them because my kids were mostly raised before they were available. For centuries, for millennia, people raised their kids without smartphones, without screens, without the internet. And kids turned out pretty good. Someone might say, yeah, but our kids have to function in a technological society. They need to learn that stuff. Well, let them learn it when they're mature, not when their personalities and their values are being formed as little children. Don't use these things as babysitters. I can't imagine why any parent would let their child take a smartphone into their bedroom with them at night. A lot of these kids are being groomed by people who are trying to, you know, exploit them sexually. They're certainly being indoctrinated from, you know, YouTube and from Facebook with woke agenda opinions. And the parents aren't even knowing what's going on in there. In fact, lots of kids have TVs in their bedrooms. I don't think a child should have a TV in the bedroom. I'm not against the TV. But a child doesn't need a TV in their bedroom. They don't need a smartphone in the bedroom. I would think that if my kids, even if they were, you know, in their teens and had smartphones, if they're in my home, they will use those smartphones when they need to use them. You know, we'll put them in a lockbox at bedtime and give them to them, you know, in the daytime, and there's limits on what they can do. If a parent doesn't put limits on their kids are going to be exposed to unlimited corruption, because that's most of what's coming across on the internet. That's most of what's coming across on TV. I would never allow, when my kids were being raised, we had a video player for playing video movies. Remember what videos were? VHS videos? We had some very selected, you know, movies we'd let our kids watch, because we didn't want them to be totally unaware of, you know, media. But we only one day, they were allowed to watch one video one day a week on Saturday. The rest of the week, we had no network TV or no cable TV. Our kids were raised without regular TV. And I always said, you know, it's not because I think I'm too good for TV. It's because I don't think I'm good enough to have a TV. TV is a temptation. I'm not sure I'm strong enough to always watch only what's worth watching. So, I mean, it's not that I'm superior and therefore I can't have a TV. It's because I'm vulnerable. I'm inferior. I'm a sinner. And so when you don't give your kids TV, it's not because you hate them. It's because you love them, because you know they're children. Now, I don't want to say much more about technology, but I will say this. There's a list of things that I was looking up about the effects of, like, the modern technology, the smartphones, and the screen time spent by kids. Here's what it's done. These are specific dangers that you get from a secular website saying, you watch out for these dangers with these things. This is not Christian saying it. There's several things. Addiction. Kids get addicted to these things. It really does something to their brains that drugs do also. It stimulates certain brain activity that very similar to addiction of substances does. You don't want your kids addicted to stuff. They become addicted. And so do adults. But adults can actually recognize it's happening and stop, hopefully. Kids are exposed to information overload. Think how little information was available to the average human being 100 years ago. I heard that when George Washington died, it took 3 weeks for that information to get through the colonies, because information couldn't travel any faster than a man on horseback. Now you can know everything going on in the world. At least you can Google it. And this makes people, frankly, more stupid. People feel smarter because they have a smartphone. But God gave you an onboard computer that's supposed to be smart. Instead, you can put it in a device and your brain doesn't have to become smart. You don't have to learn math. You've got a calculator. You don't have to learn anything. You can just Google it when you want to know it. Just ad hoc. You don't have to really know anything anymore. And a great increased number of young people don't. They don't know much of anything except what they read on Facebook or on YouTube. And so that's damaging. You don't want your kids addicted. You don't want them to have information overload because it's stressful. You don't want them to become stupid. It creates a shorter attention span. I mean, most of you are able to pay attention for this long time I've been speaking. Maybe I'm fooling myself. Maybe you're thinking about something else. But you're of an older generation. I don't think there's very many 12-year-olds that could sit this long. They should. They're adults. I mean, they should be adults. But they just can't pay attention that long most of the time because of the devices they've been addicted to. It of course, creates social isolation. People used to have real relationships with real people that you interact with. Now you have a face on a screen or something, and they have shallow relationships. They have very little relationship skills. They're socially isolated. Of course, they can be exposed to porn. You can't really protect any device from porn completely. At least not what I call porn. There's a lot of stuff that maybe the world doesn't call porn that it would have been called porn 30 years ago, but they don't call it that now. But it is porn, and it's corrupting of children and adults too. And of course, there's the whole woke ideological agenda that's been passed along through. So those are extremely concerning matters that you need to be aware of. You can't just turn your kid loose with a device because that turns you loose. It's a selfish thing parents do. just like not disciplining your children. If you don't say no to your children, it's not because you love them, it's because you love you. It's because you don't want the conflict. It's because you don't want to be the parent. You want to be the pal. And I'll tell you this, I was a single parent for over 10 years. I had a wife who left me with four minor children at home. And I know what it's like to be a single parent. I know that when you don't have your spouse there to be your partner, the temptation is to have your kids be your partner. Your kids become sort of a surrogate. You don't want your friends to not like you, your kids to not like you, because then you don't have any, you're already rejected by your mate. You know, your spouse already rejected you. The last thing you want is your kids to reject you too. And so you're under this huge pressure to please your children. And yet, pleasing your children is often the worst thing you can do for them. You want your kids to be happy, but that doesn't mean pleasing them. That doesn't mean giving them everything they want. I'll give this, I'll end with this, although I've got much more to say, but I'm going too long. I have a friend who went to a Bible school I was running, and he'd been converted out of a drug and alcohol and promiscuity background, hippie background. And he told me after he got saved, he said he had been raised by two fathers. One was his birth father, his real father. The other was his stepfather. He had spent time with both of them at different times. And he said when he was growing up, he hated his real father, because his real father wouldn't let him smoke weed. His real father wouldn't let him, you know, go out and, you know, be a rascal. His dad disciplined him. His stepdad smoked weed with him. His stepdad didn't ever say no. He said he grew up just loving his stepdad because his dad always disciplined him and his stepdad didn't. But he says, then when I became an adult, I despised my stepdad. I respect my dad. I love my dad because he cared about me. I realized as an adult looking back that he was actually taking the unpopular stand, risking my disapproval, risking me rejecting him. But because he knew that was good for me. But my stepdad, he was afraid to displease me. He was afraid to be disliked. And he was a spineless person. I have no respect for him as a man. I thought, well, that's very profound, because, I mean, I was raised by my natural parents. But here is a case of a man who had both, you know, a parent who was disciplinary and a parent that was not. And it's as I would have expected. I mean, what he said didn't really surprise me. I was just glad to hear confirmation of what I would have guessed to be true. And that is that the parent who protects, the parent that disciplines, is not making the child happy and may even incur the child's wrath at times when they're foolish children. But when they grow up and understand reality, and if you raise them right, they someday will, they'll realize that you were the one who cared for them. You're the one that sacrificed for them. You're the one they want to be show respect to. Whereas the undisciplinary parent, kids may still like their moms or their dads who are their pals and who never discipline them. They may like them, but they can't respect them. They like them like they like their pals. They don't see their parents as somebody that they are indebted to, or somebody that they respect, or somebody that they want to take advice from. They just see them as like any of their friends who don't know any more than they do and don't deserve any more respect than they do. But of course, the real issue here is not that we want our children's respect. Of course we do. We also want their love. The main thing we want is to be able to stand before God and say, here are the children that you gave me. At the end of his ministry, Jesus said, Father, those that you've given to me, I've taught them the truth, and none of them are lost except for the son of perdition, that prophecy might be fulfilled. So I had 12 kids here you gave me, lost one of them. That actually was fulfilling prophecy. The other 11, I can say, they're stalwart, they're here, and what you gave me to work with, I can present back to you still intact. And that's what every parent's going to want to be able to say when they stand before God, because there's not anything God has given you to do in your life that's more important than bringing up your children to be Christians, to be strong, to be world changers for God, at least to be faithful unto death. If you can get your kids to do that, you are a success in this world. You may have never made very much money. You may never been recognized. Your name might not be remembered very long by those who are not your own children, but you'll be remembered with respect by God and by those children. And that's what we must do. We must make sure we are paying attention to the dangers that are surrounding our children. Not just the physical dangers, but the dangers attacking their innocence, attacking their spiritual minds. And we got to say, well, what do I have to sacrifice to really watch this more closely, to spend time with kids, to be the largest influence in my children's life? There's going to be other influences, but I need to be the most present influence in their life. And if I have to take a day doing something I'd rather not do because my kids like to, take them to the park, go on a hike, go camping, do something with them, maybe even go to a movie that's not, you know, it's not threatening them spiritually, but to do something with them instead of farming them out to the public school or to the TV or to the iPad or something. Make those sacrifices. No, and I'm sure you've heard this many times before. I have. It's absolutely true. Nobody ever was on their deathbed and thought, I wish I'd made more money. Or I wish I'd spent more time being promoted in my business. Or I wish I'd done, you know, more recreational things. But many parents will die saying, I wish I'd spent more relationship time with my kids. I wish I'd planted more into them. I wish I'd just really been there for them more. I mean, everybody on their deathbed sees things, the values for what they are. We're blinded to those many times when we're in the midst of our life and we don't think the end is near. When we're at the end, if we have time and luxury to reflect back, we're saying, you know, the things that really mattered, I'm glad I did the things that really mattered. And one of those things, certainly top of the list is, besides I serve God, is I made sacrifices for my kids. I put their welfare above my own preferences and happiness. And now I'm happy. Now I'm dying happy because I made those sacrifices for them. And so protecting our kids is something that I was asked to speak about. I have a whole bunch of points I didn't have time to give because I'm so verbose. But anyway, I want to leave that with you. Obviously, I didn't say anything about this, but I would hope it goes without saying, but maybe I should say anyway. You need to pray for your kids. It's a spiritual battle out there. The demons are out there to try to drag them off to hell. You need to pray for God to send His support, His Holy Spirit, His angels, whatever's necessary, to protect your children, to reveal Himself to them, to make Himself real to them. That can only be done through prayer. I say it goes without saying only because everything that we do as Christians depends on prayer. But obviously, it shouldn't really go without saying. It needs to be said. We need to be praying for our children a lot. You'll never regret the time you spent doing that.